participate in the war. When the first contingents of U.S. troops were being sent to Saudi Arabia in August of 1990, Corporal Jeff Patterson, a 22-year-old Marine stationed in Hawaii, sat down on the runway of the airfield and refused to board a plane bound for Saudi Arabia. He asked to be discharged from the Marine Corps. "I have come to believe that there are no justified wars. I began to question exactly what I was doing in the Marine Corps about the time I began to read about history. I began to read up on America's support for the murderous regimes of Guatemala, Iran under the Shah, and El Salvador. I object to the military use of force against any people, anywhere, anytime." 14 Marine Corps reservists at Camp Lejeune, North Carolina, filed for conscientious objector status despite the prospect of a court-martial for desertion. A lance corporal in the Marines, Eric Larson, issued a statement. "I declare myself a conscientious objector. Here is my sea bag full of personal gear. Here is my gas mask. I no longer need them. I am no longer a Marine. It, to me, is embarrassing to fight for a way of life in which basic human needs like a place to sleep, one hot meal a day, and some medical attention cannot even be met in our nation's capital." Corporal Yolanda Hewitt Vaughn, a physician who was a captain in the Army Reserve Medical Corps, a mother of three young children, and a member of the Physicians for Social Responsibility, was called to active duty in December 1990, a month before the start of the war. She replied, "I am refusing orders to be an accomplice in what I consider an immoral, inhumane, and unconstitutional act, namely an offensive military mobilization in the Middle East." She was court-martialed, convicted of desertion, and sentenced to 2.5 years in prison. Another soldier, Stephanie Atkinson of Murfreesboro, Illinois, refused to report for active duty, saying she thought the U.S. military was in the Persian Gulf solely for economic reasons. She was first placed under house arrest, then given a discharge under other than honorable conditions. An Army physician named Harlow Ballard, stationed at Fort Devens in Massachusetts, refused to follow an order to go to Saudi Arabia. "I would rather go to jail than support this war," he said. "I don't believe there is any such thing as a just war." Over 1,000 reservists declared themselves conscientious objectors. A 23-year-old Marine Corps reservist named Rob Calabro was one of them. "My father tells me that he's ashamed of me. He screams at me that he's embarrassed by me. But I believe that killing people is morally wrong. I believe I am serving my country more by being true to my conscience than by living a lie." An information network sprang up during the Gulf War to tell what was not being told in the major media. There were alternative newspapers in many cities. There were over 100 community radio stations able to reach only a fraction of those tuned in to the major networks, but the only sources during the Gulf War of critical analyses of the war. An ingenious radio person in Boulder, Colorado, named David Barsamian, recorded a speech by Noam Chomsky made at Harvard, a devastating critique of the war. He then sent the cassette out to his network of community stations, which were eager for a point of view different from the official one. Two young men in New Jersey then transcribed the talk, put it in pamphlet form, in a shape easily photocopied, and placed the pamphlets in bookstores all over the country. After victorious wars, there is almost always a sobering effect, as the war fervor wears off, and citizens assess the costs and wonder what was gained. War fever was at its height in February 1991. In that month, when people being polled were reminded of the huge costs of the war, only 17% said the war was not worth it. 4 months later, in June, the figure was 30%. In the months that followed, Bush's support in the nation dropped steeply as economic conditions deteriorated. And in 1992, when the war spirit evaporated, Bush went down to defeat. After the disintegration of the Soviet bloc began in 1989, there had been talk in the United States of a peace dividend, the opportunity to take billions of dollars from the military budget and use it for human needs. The war in the Gulf became a convenient excuse for the government determined to stop such talk. A member of the Bush administration said, "We owe Saddam a favor. He saved us from the peace dividend." New York Times, March 2, 1991. But the idea of a peace dividend could not be stifled so long as Americans were in need. Shortly after the war, historian Marilyn Young warned, "The U.S. can destroy Iraq's highways, but not build its own, create the conditions for epidemic in Iraq, but not offer health care to millions of Americans. It can excoriate Iraqi treatment of the Kurdish minority, but not deal with domestic race relations, create homelessness abroad, but not solve it here, keep a 500,000 troops drug-free as part of a war, but refuse to fund the treatment of millions of drug addicts at home. We shall lose the war after we have won it." In 1992, the limits of military victory became apparent during the quincentennial celebrations of Columbus's arrival in the Western Hemisphere. 500 years ago, Columbus and his fellow conquerors had wiped out the native population of Hispaniola. This was followed during the next 4 centuries by the methodical destruction of Indian tribes by the United States government as it marched across the continent. But now there was a dramatic reaction. The Indians, the Native Americans, had become a visible force since the 60s and 70s, and in 1992 were joined by other Americans to denounce the quincentennial celebrations. For the first time in all the years that the country had celebrated Columbus Day, there were nationwide protests against honoring a man who had kidnapped, enslaved, mutilated, murdered the natives, who greeted his arrival with gifts and friendship. Preparations for the quincentennial began on both sides of the controversy. Official commissions, nationally and in the states, were set up long before the year of the quincentennial. This spurred action by Native Americans. In the summer of 1990, 350 Indians, representatives from all over the hemisphere, met in Quito, Ecuador, at the first intercontinental gathering of indigenous people in the Americas, to mobilize against the glorification of the Columbus conquest. The following summer, in Davis, California, over 100 Native Americans gathered for a follow-up meeting to the Quito Conference. They declared, October 12, 1992, International Day of Solidarity with Indigenous People, and resolved to inform the King of Spain that the replicas of Columbus's 3 ships, the Nina, Pinta, and Santa Maria, will not receive permission from the native nations to land in the Western Hemisphere unless he apologizes for the original incursion 500 years ago. The movement grew. The largest ecumenical body in the United States, the National Council of Churches, called on Christians to refrain from celebrating the Columbus Quincentennial, saying, "What represented newness of freedom, hope, and opportunity for some was the occasion for oppression, degradation, and genocide for others." The National Endowment for the Humanities funded a traveling exhibition called First Encounter, which romanticized the Columbus conquest. When the exhibition opened at the Florida Museum of National History, Michelle Diamond, a freshman at the University of Florida, climbed aboard a replica of one of Columbus's ships with a sign reading, "Exhibit teaches racism." She said, "It's a human issue, not just a red Indian issue." She was arrested and charged with trespassing, but demonstrations continued for 16 days against the exhibit. A newspaper called Indigenous Thought began publication in early 1991 to create a link among all the counter-Columbus quincentenary activities. It carried articles by Native Americans about current struggles over lands stolen by treaty. In Corpus Christi, Texas, Indians and Chicanos joined to protest the city's celebrations of the quincentennial. A woman named Angelina Mendez spoke for the Chicanos. "The Chicano Nation, in solidarity with our Indian brothers and sisters to the north, come together with them on this day to denounce the atrocity the U.S. government proposes in reenacting the arrival of the Spanish, more specifically, the arrival of Cristobal Colón to the shores of this land." The Columbus controversy brought an extraordinary burst of educational and cultural activity. A professor at the University of California at San Diego, Deborah Small, put together an exhibit of over 200 paintings on wood panels called 1492. She juxtaposed words from Columbus's diary with blown-up fragments from 16th-century engravings to dramatize the horrors that accompanied Columbus's arrival in the hemisphere. A reviewer wrote that, "It does remind us, in the most vivid way, of how the coming of Western-style civilization to the New World doesn't provide us with a sunny tale." When President Bush attacked Iraq in 1991, claiming that he was acting to end the Iraqi occupation of Kuwait, a group of Native Americans in Oregon distributed a biting and ironic open letter. "Dear President Bush, please send your assistance in freeing our small nation from occupation. This foreign force occupied our lands to steal our rich resources. They used biological warfare and deceit, killing thousands of elders, children, and women in the process. As they overwhelmed our land, they deposed our leaders and people of our own government, and in its place, they installed their own government systems that yet today control our daily lives in many ways. As in your own words, the occupation and overthrow of one small nation is one too many. Sincerely, an American Indian." The publication, Rethinking Schools, which represented socially conscious school teachers all over the country, printed a 100-page book called Rethinking Columbus, featuring articles by Native Americans and others, a critical review of children's books on Columbus, a listing of resources for people wanting more information on Columbus, and more reading material on counter-quincentenary. The publication Rethinking Schools, which represented socially conscious school teachers all over the country, printed a 100-page book called Rethinking Columbus, featuring articles by Native Americans and others, a critical review of children's books on Columbus, a listing of resources for people wanting more information on Columbus, and more reading material on counter-quincentenary activities. In a few months, 200,000 copies of the book were sold. A Portland, Oregon teacher named Bill Bigelow, who helped put together Rethinking Schools, took a year off from his regular job to tour the country in 1992, giving workshops to other teachers so that they could begin to tell those truths about the Columbus experience that were omitted from the traditional books and class curricula. One of Bigelow's own students wrote to the publisher Allen and Bacon with a critique of their history text, The American Spirit. "I'll just pick one topic to keep it simple. How about Columbus? No, you didn't lie, but saying, though they had a keen interest in the peoples of the Caribbean, Columbus and his crews were never able to live peacefully among them. Makes it seem as if Columbus did no wrong. The reason for not being able to live peacefully is that he and crew took slaves and killed thousands of Indians for not bringing enough gold." Another student wrote, It seemed to me as if the publishers had just printed up some glory story that was supposed to make us feel more patriotic about our country. They want us to look at our country as great and powerful and forever right. A student named Rebecca wrote, "Of course the writers of the books probably think it's harmless enough. What does it matter who discovered America, really? But the thought that I have been lied to all my life about this, and who knows what else, really makes me angry." A group was formed on the West Coast called Italian Americans Against Christopher Columbus, saying, "When Italian Americans identify with Native people, we are bringing ourselves, each of us, closer to possible change in the world." In Los Angeles, a high school student named Blake Lindsay went before the city council to argue against celebrating the quincentennial. She spoke to the council about the genocide of the Arawaks, but she got no official response. However, when she told her story on a talk show, a woman phoned in who said she was from Haiti. "The girl is right. We have no Indians left. At our last uprising in Haiti, people destroyed the statue of Columbus. Let's have statues for the Aborigines." There were counter-Columbus activities all over the country, unmentioned in the press or on television. In Minnesota alone, a listing for such activities for 1992 reported dozens of workshops, meetings, films, art shows. At Lincoln Center in New York City on October 12th, there was a performance of Leonard Lerman's New World, an opera about what Columbus did to the Indians. In Baltimore, there was a multimedia show about Columbus. In Boston, and then in a national tour, the Underground Railway Theater performed the Christopher Columbus Follies to packed audiences. The protests, the dozens of new books that were appearing about Indian history, the discussions taking place all over the country were bringing about an extraordinary transformation in the educational world. For generations, exactly the same story had been told all American schoolchildren about Columbus, a romantic, admiring story. Now, thousands of teachers around the country were beginning to tell that story differently. This aroused anger among defenders of the old history, who derided what they called a movement for political correctness and multiculturalism. They resented the critical treatment of Western expansion and imperialism, which they considered an attack on Western civilization. Ronald Reagan's Secretary of Education, William Bennett, had called Western civilization our common culture, its highest ideas and aspirations. A much-publicized book by a philosopher named Alan Bloom, The Closing of the American Mind, expressed horror at what the social movements of the 60s had done to change the educational atmosphere of American universities. To him, Western civilization was the high point of human progress, and the United States its best representative. America tells one story, the unbroken, ineluctable progress of freedom and equality. From its first settlers and its political foundings on, there has been no dispute that freedom and equality are the essence of justice for us. In the 70s and 80s, disabled people organized and created a movement powerful enough to bring about the passage by Congress of the Americans with Disabilities Act. It was an unprecedented piece of legislation, setting standards which would enable persons with disabilities to contest discrimination against them and ensuring they would have access to places where their disabilities would otherwise bar them. In the civil rights movement, black people disputed that claim of America's standing for freedom and equality. The women's movement had disputed that claim, too. And now, in 1992, Native Americans were pointing to the crimes of Western civilization against their ancestors. They were recalling the communitarian spirit of the Indians Columbus met and conquered, trying to tell the history of those millions of people who were here before Columbus, giving the lie to what a Harvard historian, Perry Miller, had called the movement of European culture into the vacant wilderness of America. As the United States entered the 90s, the political system, whether Democrats or Republicans were in power, remained in the control of those who had great wealth. The main instruments of information were also dominated by corporate wealth. The country was divided, though no mainstream political leader would speak of it, into classes of extreme wealth and extreme poverty, separated by an insecure and jeopardized middle class. Yet there was unquestionably, though largely unreported, what a worried mainstream journalist had called a permanent adversarial culture which refused to surrender the possibility of a more equal, more humane society. If there was hope for the future of America, it lay in the promise of that refusal. Chapter 23. The Clinton Presidency. The 8-year presidential term of Bill Clinton, a personable, articulate graduate of Yale Law School, a Rhodes Scholar, and former governor of Arkansas, began with a hope that a bright young person would bring to the country what he promised, change. But Clinton's presidency ended with no chance that it would, as he had wished, make his mark in history as one of the nation's great presidents. His last year in office was marked by sensational scandals surrounding his personal life. More important, he left no legacy of bold innovation in domestic policy or departure from traditional nationalist foreign policy. At home, he surrendered again and again to caution and conservatism, signing legislation that was more pleasing to the Republican Party and big business than to those Democrats who still recalled the bold programs of Franklin Roosevelt. Abroad, there were futile shows of military braggadocio and a subservience to what President Dwight Eisenhower had once warned against, the military-industrial complex. Clinton had barely won election both times. In 1992, with 45% of the voting population staying away from the polls, he only received 43% of the votes, the senior Bush getting 38%. While 19% of the voters showed their distaste for both parties by voting for a third-party candidate, Ross Perot. In 1996, with half the population not voting, Clinton won 49% of the votes against a lackluster Republican candidate, Robert Dole. There was a distinct absence of voter enthusiasm. One bumper sticker read, "If God had intended us to vote, he would have given us candidates." At his second inauguration ceremony, Clinton spoke of the nation at the edge of a new century in a new millennium. He said, "We need a new government for a new century." But Clinton's rhetoric was not matched by his performance. It happened that the inauguration coincided with the nationwide celebration of the birthday of Martin Luther King, Jr., and Clinton invoked King's name several times in his address. The two men, however, represented very different social philosophies. By the time King was assassinated in 1968, he had come to believe that our economic system was fundamentally unjust and needed radical transformation. He spoke of the evils of capitalism and asked for a radical redistribution of economic and political power. On the other hand, as major corporations gave money to the Democratic Party on an unprecedented scale, Clinton demonstrated clearly his total confidence in the market system and private enterprise. During his 1992 campaign, the chief executive officer of Martin Marietta Corporation, which held huge and lucrative government contracts for military production, noted, "I think the Democrats are moving more toward business, and business is moving more toward the Democrats." Martin Luther King's reaction to the buildup of military power had been the same as his reaction to the Vietnam War. "This madness must cease," and The evils of racism, economic exploitation, and militarism are all tied together. Clinton was willing to recall King's dream of racial equality, but not his dream of a society rejecting violence. Even though the Soviet Union was no longer a military threat, he insisted that the United States must keep its armed forces dispersed around the globe, prepare for two regional wars, and maintain the military budget at Cold War levels. Despite his lofty rhetoric, Clinton showed in his 8 years in office that he, like other politicians, was more interested in electoral victory than in social change. To get more votes, he decided he must move the party closer to the center. This meant doing just enough for blacks, women, and working people to keep their support, while trying to win over white conservative voters with a program of toughness on crime, stern measures on welfare, and a strong military. Clinton in office followed this plan quite scrupulously. He made a few cabinet appointments that suggested support for labor and for social welfare programs, and appointed a black pro-labor man as head of the National Labor Relations Board. But his key appointments to the Treasury and Commerce Departments were wealthy corporate lawyers, and his foreign policy staff, the Secretary of Defense, the Director of the CIA, the National Security Advisor, were traditional players on the bipartisan Cold War team. Clinton appointed more people of color to government posts than his Republican predecessors. But if any prospective or actual appointees became too bold, Clinton abandoned them quickly. His Secretary of Commerce, Ronald Brown, who was killed in a plane crash, was black and a corporate lawyer, and Clinton was clearly pleased with him. On the other hand, Lanny Guineer, a black legal scholar who was being considered for a job with the Civil Rights Division of the Justice Department, was abandoned when conservatives objected to her strong ideas on matters of racial equality and voter representation. And when Surgeon General Jocelyn Elders, a black, made the controversial suggestion that masturbation was a proper subject in sex education, Clinton asked her to resign. This was especially ironic considering Clinton's later sexual adventures in the White House. He showed the same timidity in the two appointments he made to the Supreme Court, making sure that Ruth Bader Ginsburg and Stephen Breyer would be moderate enough to be acceptable to Republicans as well as to Democrats. He was not willing to fight for a strong liberal to follow in the footsteps of Thurgood Marshall or William Brennan, who had recently left the court. Breyer and Ginsburg both defended the constitutionality of capital punishment and upheld drastic restrictions on the use of habeas corpus. Both voted with the most conservative judges on the court to uphold the constitutional right of Boston St. Patrick's Day parade organizers to exclude gay marchers. In choosing judges for the lower federal courts, Clinton showed himself no more likely to appoint liberals than the Republican Gerald Ford had in the 70s. According to a 3-year study published in the Fordham Law Review in early 1996, Clinton's appointments made liberal decisions in less than half their cases. The New York Times noted that while Reagan and Bush had been willing to fight for judges who would reflect their philosophies, Mr. Clinton, in contrast, has been quick to drop judicial candidates if there is even a hint of controversy. Clinton was eager to show he was tough on matters of law and order. Running for president in 1992, while still governor of Arkansas, he flew back to Arkansas to oversee the execution of a mentally retarded man on death row. And early in his administration, in April 1993, he and Attorney General Janet Reno approved an FBI attack on a group of religious zealots who were armed and ensconced in a building complex in Waco, Texas. Instead of waiting for negotiations to bring about a solution, the FBI attacked with rifle fire, tanks, and gas, resulting in a fire that swept through the compound, killing at least 86 men, women, and children. One of the few survivors of the Waco tragedy was David Thibodeau, who in his book, A Place Called Waco, gives us a rare inside description of the human consequences of the government attack. Despite the fact that more than 30 women and children were crowded into the narrow concrete chamber at the base of the residential tower, the tank crashed into the ceiling, shoving chunks of broken concrete onto the people huddled below. 6 women and kids were immediately crushed by falling blocks. The rest were suffocated by the dust and gas vapors as the tank injected massive doses of CS directly into their windowless, unventilated shelter. The charred corpse of 6-year-old Star, David's oldest daughter, David Koresh was the leader of the religious sect, was found with her spine bent into a backward bow until her head almost touched her feet. Her muscles were contracted by the combined effect of the fire's heat and the cyanide in her body, a byproduct of CS gas suffocation. Clinton and Reno gave feeble excuses for what clearly was a reckless decision to launch a military attack on a group of men, women, and children. Reno at one time talked of children being molested, which was totally unsubstantiated, and even if true, could hardly justify the massacre that took place. As so often happens in cases where the government commits murder, the surviving victims were put on trial, with the judge overruling the request of the jury not to levy harsh sentences and ruling for imprisonment up to 40 years. Professor James Fife of Temple University, who taught criminal justice, said, "There is no FBI to investigate the FBI. There is no Justice Department to investigate the Justice Department." One of the people sentenced by the judge was Rinos Avram, who commented, "This nation is supposed to run under laws, not personal feelings. When you ignore the law, you sow the seeds of terrorism." This turned out to be a prophetic statement. Timothy McVeigh, who some years after the Waco tragedy was convicted of bombing the federal building in Oklahoma City, which cost 168 lives, had visited the Waco site twice. Later, according to an FBI affidavit, McVeigh was extremely agitated about the government's assault on Waco. Clinton's law and order approach led him early in his first term to sign legislation cutting funds for state resource centers that supplied lawyers to indigent prisoners. The result, according to Bob Herbert, writing in the New York Times, was that a man facing the death penalty in Georgia had to appear at a habeas corpus proceeding without a lawyer. In 1996, the president signed legislation that made it more difficult for judges to put prison systems under special masters to ensure the improvement of terrible prison conditions. He also approved a new statute withholding federal funds for legal services where lawyers use those funds to handle class action suits. Such suits were important for challenging assaults on civil liberties. The Crime Bill of 1996, which both Republicans and Democrats in Congress voted for overwhelmingly, and which Clinton endorsed with enthusiasm, dealt with the problem of crime by emphasizing punishment, not prevention. It extended the death penalty to a whole range of criminal offenses and provided $8 billion for the building of new prisons. All this was to persuade voters that politicians were tough on crime. But as criminologist Todd Clear wrote in the New York Times, "Tougher is Dumber," about the new crime bill, harsher sentencing had added 1 million people to the prison population, giving the United States the highest rate of incarceration in the world, and yet violent crime continued to increase. Why, Clear asked, do harsh penalties seem to have so little to do with crime? A crucial reason is that police and prisons have virtually no effect on the sources of criminal behavior. He pointed to those sources. About 70% of prisoners in New York State come from 8 neighborhoods in New York City. These neighborhoods suffer profound poverty, exclusion, marginalization, and despair. All these things nourish crime. Those holding political power, whether Clinton or his Republican predecessors, had something in common. They sought to keep their power by diverting the anger of citizens to groups without the resources to defend themselves. As H.L. Mencken, the acerbic social critic of the 1920s, put it, "The whole aim of practical politics is to keep the populace alarmed by menacing it with an endless series of hobgoblins, all of them imaginary." Criminals were among these hobgoblins, also immigrants, people on welfare, and certain governments, Iraq, North Korea, Cuba. By turning attention to them, by inventing or exaggerating their dangers, the failures of the American system could be concealed. Immigrants were a convenient object of attack, because as non-voters, their interests could be safely ignored. It was easy for politicians to play upon the xenophobia that has erupted from time to time in American history, the anti-Irish prejudices of the mid-19th century, the continual violence against Chinese who had been brought in to work on the railroads, the hostility toward immigrants from Eastern and Southern Europe that led to the restrictive immigration laws of the 1920s. The reform spirit of the 60s had led to an easing of restrictions on immigration, but in the 90s, Democrats and Republicans alike played on the economic fears of working Americans. Jobs were being lost because corporations were firing employees to save money, downsizing, or moving plants out of the country to more profitable situations. Immigrants, especially the large numbers coming over the southern border from Mexico, were blamed for taking jobs from citizens of the United States, for receiving government benefits, for causing higher taxes on American citizens. Both major political parties joined to pass legislation, which Clinton then signed, to remove welfare benefits, food stamps, payments to elderly and disabled people, from not only illegal but legal immigrants. By early 1997, letters were going out to close to 1 million legal immigrants who were poor, old, or disabled, warning them that their food stamps and cash payments would be cut off in a few months unless they became citizens. For perhaps 500,000 legal immigrants, passing the tests required for becoming a citizen was quite impossible. They could not read English, were sick or disabled, or were just too old to learn. An immigrant from Portugal living in Massachusetts told a reporter through an interpreter, "Every day we are afraid the letter will come. What will we do if we lose our checks? We will starve. Oh my God, it will not be worth living." Illegal immigrants fleeing poverty in Mexico began to face harsher treatment in the early 90s. Thousands of border guards were added. A Reuters dispatch from Mexico City, April 3, 1997, said about the tougher policy, "Any crackdown against illegal immigration automatically angers Mexicans, millions of whom migrate legally and illegally across the 2,000-mile border to the United States in search of jobs each year." Hundreds of thousands of Central Americans who had fled death squads in Guatemala and El Salvador, while the United States was giving military aid to those governments, now faced deportation because they had never been deemed political refugees. To admit that these cases were political would have given the lie to U.S. claims at the time that those repressive regimes were improving their human rights record and therefore deserved to continue receiving military aid. In early 1996, Congress and the President joined to pass an Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act, allowing deportation of any immigrant ever convicted of a crime, no matter how long ago or how serious. Lawful permanent residents who had married Americans and now had children were not exempt. The New York Times reported that July that Hundreds of long-term legal residents have been arrested since the law passed. There was a certain irrationality to this new law, for it was passed in response to the blowing up of the federal building in Oklahoma City by Timothy McVeigh, who was native-born. The new government policy toward immigrants, far from fulfilling Clinton's promise of a new government for a new century, was a throwback to the notorious Alien and Sedition Laws of 1798 and the McCarthy-era McCarran-Walter Act of the 1950s. It was hardly in keeping with the grand claim inscribed on the Statue of Liberty, "Give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to breathe free, the wretched refuse of your teeming shore. Send these, the homeless, tempest-tossed to me. I lift my lamp beside the golden door." In the summer of 1996, apparently seeking the support of centrist voters for the coming election, Clinton signed a law to end the federal government's guarantee, created under the New Deal, of financial help to poor families with dependent children. This was called welfare reform, and the law itself had the deceptive title of Personal Responsibility and Work Opportunity Reconciliation Act of 1996. By this decision, Clinton alienated many of his former liberal supporters. Peter Edelman resigned from his post in the Department of Health, Education, and Welfare, bitterly criticizing what he considered Clinton's surrender to the right and the Republicans. Later, Edelman wrote, "His goal was re-election at all costs. His political approach was not to calculate the risks, but to take no risks at all. His penchant for elevating shadow over substance has hurt poor children." The aim of welfare reform was to force poor families receiving federal cash benefits, many of them single mothers with children, to go to work by cutting off their benefits after 2 years, limiting lifetime benefits to 5 years, and allowing people without children to get food stamps for only 3 months in any 3-year period. The Los Angeles Times reported, "As legal immigrants lose access to Medicaid and families battle a new 5-year limit on cash benefits, health experts anticipate resurgence of tuberculosis and sexually transmitted diseases. The aim of the welfare cuts was to save $50 billion over a 5-year period, less than the cost of a planned new generation of fighter planes." Even the New York Times, a supporter of Clinton during the election, said that the provisions of the new law had nothing to do with creating work, but everything to do with balancing the budget by cutting programs for the poor. There was a simple but overwhelming problem with cutting off benefits to the poor to force them to find jobs. There were not jobs available for all those who would lose their benefits. In New York City in 1990, when 2,000 jobs were advertised in the sanitation department at $23,000 a year, 100,000 people applied. 2 years later in Chicago, 7,000 people showed up for 550 jobs at Stouffer's, a restaurant chain. In Joliet, Illinois, 200 showed up at Commonwealth Edison at 4:30 a.m. to apply for jobs that did not yet exist. In early 1997, 4,000 people lined up for 700 jobs at the Roosevelt Hotel in Manhattan. It was estimated that at the existing rate of job growth in New York, with 470,000 adults on welfare, it would take 24 years to absorb those thrown off the rolls. What the Clinton administration steadfastly refused to do was to establish government programs to create jobs, as had been done in the New Deal era, when billions were spent to give employment to several million people, from construction workers and engineers to artists and writers. "The era of big government is over," Clinton proclaimed as he ran for president in 1996, seeking votes on the supposition that Americans supported the Republican position that government was spending too much. Both parties were misreading public opinion, and the press was often complicit in this. When, in the mid-year election of 1994, only 37% of the electorate went to the polls, and slightly more than half voted Republican, the media reported this as a revolution. A headline in the New York Times read, "Public shows trust in GOP Congress," suggesting that the American people were supporting the Republican agenda of less government. But in the story below that headline, a New York Times CBS News public opinion survey found that 65% of those polled said that it is the responsibility of government to take care of people who can't take care of themselves. Clinton and the Republicans, in joining against big government, were aiming only at social services. The other manifestations of big government, huge contracts to military contractors and generous subsidies to corporations, continued at exorbitant levels. Big government had, in fact, begun with the founding fathers, who deliberately set up a strong central government to protect the interests of the bondholders, the slave owners, the land speculators, the manufacturers. For the next 200 years, the American government continued to serve the interests of the wealthy and powerful, offering millions of acres of free land to the railroads, setting high tariffs to protect manufacturers, giving tax breaks to oil corporations, and using its armed forces to suppress strikes and rebellions. It was only in the 20th century, especially in the 30s and 60s, when the government, besieged by protests and fearful of the stability of the system, passed social legislation for the poor, that political leaders and business executives complained about big government. President Clinton reappointed Alan Greenspan as head of the Federal Reserve System, which regulated interest rates. Greenspan's chief concern was to avoid inflation, which bondholders did not want because it would reduce their profits. His financial constituency saw higher wages for workers as producing inflation and worried that if there was not enough unemployment, wages might rise. Reduction of the annual deficit in order to achieve a balanced budget became an obsession of the Clinton administration. But since Clinton did not want to raise taxes on the wealthy or to cut funds for the military, the only alternative was to sacrifice the poor, the children, the aged, to spend less for health care, for food stamps, for education, for single mothers. Two examples of this appeared early in Clinton's second administration, in the spring of 1997. From the New York Times, May 8, 1997, a major element of President Clinton's education plan, a proposal to spend $5 billion to repair the nation's crumbling schools, was among the items quietly killed in last week's agreement to balance the federal budget. From the Boston Globe, May 22, 1997. After White House intervention, the Senate yesterday rejected a proposal to extend health insurance to the nation's 10.5 million uninsured children. Seven lawmakers switched their votes after senior White House officials called and said the amendment would imperil the delicate budget agreement. The concern about balancing the budget did not extend to military spending. Immediately after he was elected for the first time, Clinton had said, "I want to reaffirm the essential continuity in American foreign policy." In Clinton's presidency, the government continued to spend at least $250 billion a year to maintain the military machine. He was accepting the Republican claim that the nation must be ready to fight two regional wars simultaneously, despite the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1989. At that time, Bush's Secretary of Defense, Dick Cheney, had said, "The threats have become so remote that they are difficult to discern." General Colin Powell spoke similarly, reported in Defense News, April 8, 1991. "I'm running out of demons. I'm running out of villains. I'm down to Castro and Kim Il-sung. Clinton had been accused during the election campaign of having evaded military service during the Vietnam War, apparently in opposition to the war, like so many other young Americans. Once in the White House, he seemed determined to erase the image of a draft dodger and took every opportunity to portray himself as a supporter of the military establishment. In the fall of 1993, Clinton's Secretary of Defense, Les Aspin, announced the results of a bottom-up review of the military budget, envisioning the spending of over $1 trillion for the next 5 years. It called for virtually no reduction in major weapons systems. A conservative analyst with the Woodrow Wilson International Center, Anthony Cordesman, commented, "There are no radical departures from the Bush base force, or even from earlier U.S. strategy." After being in office 2 years and facing a Republican upsurge in the congressional elections of 1994, Clinton proposed even more money for the military than had been envisioned in the bottom-up review. A New York Times dispatch from Washington, December 1, 1994, reported, "Trying to quiet Republican criticism that the military is underfinanced, President Clinton held a Rose Garden ceremony today to announce that he would seek a $25 billion increase in military spending over the next 6 years. The examples most often given by the Pentagon of two simultaneous major regional wars were Iraq and North Korea. Yet the 1991 war against Iraq had followed repeated U.S. arming of Iraq in the 80s, and it was reasonable to suppose that heavy military aid to South Korea and a permanent U.S. military force in that country had provoked increases in the North Korean arms budget, which was still much smaller than that of South Korea. Despite these facts, the United States under Clinton was continuing to supply arms to nations all over the world. Clinton, coming into office, approved the sale of F-15 combat planes to Saudi Arabia and F-16s to Taiwan. The Baltimore Sun reported, May 30, 1994, "Next year, for the first time, the United States will produce more combat planes for foreign air forces than for the Pentagon, highlighting America's replacement of the Soviet Union as the world's main arms supplier." Encouraged by the Clinton administration, the defense industry last year had its best export year ever, having sold $32 billion worth of weapons overseas, more than twice the 1992 total of $15 billion. That pattern continued through the Clinton presidency. In the summer of 2000, the New York Times reported that in the previous year, the United States had sold over $11 billion of arms, one-third of all weapons sold worldwide. Two-thirds of all arms were sold to poor countries. In 1999, the Clinton administration lifted a ban on advanced weapons to Latin America. The Times called it a victory for the big military contractors like the Lockheed Martin Corporation and the McDonnell Douglas Corporation. Clinton seemed anxious to show strength. He had been in office barely 6 months when he sent the Air Force to drop bombs on Baghdad, presumably in retaliation for an assassination plot against George Bush on the occasion of his visit to Kuwait. The evidence for such a plot was very weak, coming as it did from the notoriously corrupt Kuwaiti police, and Clinton did not wait for the results of the trial supposed to take place in Kuwait of those accused of the plot. And so, U.S. planes, claiming to have targeted intelligence headquarters in the Iraqi capital, bombed a suburban neighborhood, killing at least 6 people, including a prominent Iraqi artist and her husband. The Boston Globe reported, "Since the raid, President Clinton and other officials have boasted of crippling Iraq's intelligence capacity and of sending a powerful message that Iraq leader Saddam Hussein had better behave. It turned out later that there was no significant damage, if any, to Iraqi intelligence facilities, and the New York Times commented, "Mr. Clinton's sweeping statement was reminiscent of the assertions by President Bush and General Norman Schwarzkopf during the Persian Gulf War that later proved to be untrue." Democrats rallied behind the bombing, and the Boston Globe, referring to the use of Article 51 of the United Nations Charter as legal justification for the bombing, said this was diplomatically the proper rationale to invoke. Clinton's reference to the UN Charter conveyed the American desire to respect international law. In fact, Article 51 of the UN Charter permits unilateral military action only in defense against an armed attack and only when there is no opportunity to convene the Security Council. None of these factors were present in the Baghdad bombing. Columnist Molly Ivins suggested that the bombing of Baghdad for the purpose of sending a powerful message fit the definition of terrorism. The maddening thing about terrorists is that they are indiscriminate in their acts of vengeance or cries for attention or whatever. What is true for individuals must also be true of nations. The bombing of Baghdad was a sign that Clinton, facing several foreign policy crises during his two terms in office, would react to them in traditional ways, usually involving military action, claiming humanitarian motives, and often with disastrous results for people abroad as well as for the United States. In Somalia, East Africa, in June 1993, with the country in a civil war and people desperate for food, the United States intervened late and badly. As journalist Scott Peterson wrote in Me Against My Brother at War in Somalia, Sudan, and Rwanda, "American and other foreign forces in Somalia committed startling acts of savagery, hiding behind the banner of the United Nations. The Clinton administration made the mistake of intervening in an internal conflict between warlords. It decided to hunt down the most prominent of these, General Mohamed Aidid, in a military operation that ended with the killing of 19 Americans and perhaps 2,000 Somalis in October 1993. The attention of the American public was concentrated, as usual, on the deaths of Americans, glamorized in the film Black Hawk Down. The lives of Somali seemed much less important. As Peterson wrote, "American and UN officers made clear that numbers of Somali dead did not interest them, and they kept no count. In fact, the killing of the American Rangers by an angry Somali mob was preceded months before by a critical decision made by the United States to launch a military attack on a house in which tribal elders were meeting. It was a brutal operation. First, Cobra attack helicopters launched anti-tank missiles. Minutes later," Peterson reports, "American ground troops stormed in and began finishing off the survivors, a charge U.S. commanders deny. But a survivor of the raid told Peterson, if they saw people shouting, they killed them. U.S. General Thomas Montgomery called the attack legitimate because they were all bad guys. Admiral Jonathan Howe, representing the U.N. operation, the United States had insisted an American must be in charge, defended the attack by saying the house was a very key terrorist planning cell and denied that civilians had died, though it was clear that the dead were tribal elders. The claim was that tactical radios were found in the compound later, but Peterson wrote, I have never heard or seen any evidence that this attack even remotely met a single criteria of direct military advantage." Peterson commented, "Though we all had eyes and had witnessed the crime, mission commanders defended the indefensible and stubbornly clung to the illusion that more war could somehow bring peace. They thought that Somalis would forget the carnage, forget the spilled blood of their fathers and brothers. The Somalis did not forget, and the killing of the American Rangers in October was one consequence. The catastrophic policy in Somalia led to another one the following year in Rwanda, where famine and murderous tribal warfare were ignored. There was a UN force in Rwanda that might have saved tens of thousands of lives, but the United States insisted that it be cut back to a skeleton force. The result was genocide. At least 1 million Rwandans